This is the second interview with Miriam Allen DeFord on March 8, 1973. Interviewer Sherna Gluck, Feminist History Research Project. The interview again took place in Miriam Allen DeFord's study of her suite in the rather dilapidated Hotel Ambassador. The previous interview covered her years until her initial political involvement when she met her first husband, Olmsted Collier, in Boston. It was these years in which her suffrage activity took place and in which her feminism took form. The interview today began with the year 1915 when she moved to San Diego to marry Collier. She discusses her attitude towards work and the importance of her being independent regardless of if her husband could support her or not. And she describes her various jobs and primary commitment to writing. It is in this period of her life that she became involved as a labor writer, an occupation which she pursued till 1956. Her primary identification, however, has always been as a writer, and most of her jobs have been just to support herself. It was in 1942 that she was able to start supporting herself from her writing. At the end of the discussion of her involvement as a labor editor, which is not a very detailed discussion, we again return to the topic of feminism and discuss some of her feminist values and beliefs, as well as the attitudes of the males in her radical circles towards women. She briefly discusses some aspects of both her marriages and her attitude towards the legalization of marriage.
Really, I should say that I started any active interest in the labor movement or in left-wing politics about the time that I got acquainted at Ford Hall, because that was the first time I'd ever heard people speak from that belonged to my group. And then by the time I got to San Diego, of course, I was completely indoctrinated. So that from that time on, mostly I took it out in writing, though I did a lot of public speaking. The first thing, when I lived in Los Angeles in 1916, I can't remember now through whom, but I got acquainted with Schmidt and Kaplan, who were two of the, in the McNamara case, the Los Angeles Times explosion. And they were in the county jail where I first visited them. Afterwards, I got to know them quite well, and Captain Schmidt, Matt's sister, became a very good friend of ours. And, let me see. In 1917, I went to Spokane, and that was the Moon case, of course, had started then. And that, I guess, is the last time I did any actual soapboxing on the street.
Was for the Mooney case?
For the Mooney, the Mooney and Billings.
In San Diego, had you done soapboxing?
No, in San Diego, I never did any kind of public. After all, I was working for the public stenographer. I tell you, the only thing I can remember that has any connection in San Diego was one time when, what was his name, Anton Johansson, who was one of Emma Goldman's crowd, walked into my office and dictated a long letter to Emma Goldman. And then asked me if I knew who it was, and started to E.G. So I said it was Elizabeth Gurley Flynn. He said, no, it was Emma Goldman. And I don't know how he happened to come in. He may have just been looking for a stenographer. And but I asked him over to our house in Coronado. And unfortunately, he didn't make a hit with my husband, because when the answer was very puritanical about speech, and Johansson was full of four-letter words. I remember when he left, Johansson said, open all the windows, I can't stand it. The next day, Johansson and somebody, Tweetmo, or something like that, it was sweet, came in again and dictated some more letters, and much to my annoyance, they dictated, they wrote, and it was Emma Goldman or somebody else, about their visit, and made uncomplimentary remarks about us. I thought that was a rather rude thing to do.
They did that in the letter that you dictated?
Oh, I have to sign it, after all. Anything anybody dictated to me that wasn't actually illegal, I had to take. I charge them all the traffic would bear.
Now, so in San Diego, you were working as a public stenographer.
Yeah, most of the time.
And you just had a little office?
I had an office in San Diego. We live in Coronado. I went over every day. It was a ferry there in the bridge. And I was right downtown. I had a little, funny little office on the mezzanine floor of an office building. And I think it was a Fifth and Spring, but I can't remember anymore the streets down there.
Now, did you work because you didn't want him to support you, or because he had enough money to support both of you, didn't he?
Both. I mean, I never would be willing to have anybody support me. But also, at that time, he didn't have that much money by any means. I don't suppose we could have lived comfortably if I hadn't been working. As a matter of fact, he had no regular income. He had a very, very rich cousin who had been brought up as a brother in his house, who was head of all the streetcar and subway advertising in New York, Baron Collier, and he used to send him money from time to time.
So were you actually supporting him or just yourself?
Oh, I don't know. I've never had that situation. I mean, men and I were the same way. We both earned all we could, and we put it together. And never thought whether it was his or mine. In other words, it was in both cases. I should say it was just a question of the couple earning their living.
But you wouldn't, for instance, if Olmsted Collier could have supported you and you could have written.
Well, I never
would. Would you have been willing to do that?
No. Well, I wrote just the same. That's when I started writing for poetry, for instance. But, and besides, when you're a public stenographer, a lot of times when you have a typewriter and nobody using it but you, so I got a lot of writing done now. But, I don't know. It never even occurred to either of us that I wouldn't be working.
Now, in San Diego, did you become involved with any labor activities there? In San Diego, did you become involved in any labor or political activities?
The only thing I can remember was the time that Emma Goldman was going to have a meeting in San Diego, and the police had threatened it. So I was, I don't know who, some of the people we met asked me that I would help hold the fort, and I don't remember anything except sitting at the top of the stairs in case a cop came. I mean, none did. The meeting was held that evening.
Was this that second time after they'd first been run out of town, or was this the invasion
it was before we were in the war, you know, and it was long before all foreign-born radicals were deported. As I remember, that night, she was there, and Sasha Gold.
Was Berkman. Reitman there, too?
Reitman wasn't there that night. I met him again later on. Maynard had known him before when he debated with Emma Goldman and Everett. But the one thing I remember about that evening is Emma had that magazine, you know, called Mother Earth, and I bought a copy, and she came over across the hall later and said, "Let me see that copy I sold you." Oh, I know what it was. There was something of it scrawled on the outside of it. So I took it back to her and said, "I wanted one that hadn't been defaced." And she looked at me in horror and said, "How did you get that copy? That's the one that I was giving to Sasha." Some kind of message written to her on the outside. I think that's the last time I ever saw her.
Sasha, spoke you must have seen here during night, the Mooney thing, didn't you? But Berkman you must have seen in San Francisco when he was editing The Blast.
Well, I went to, I stopped over in San Francisco the first time on my way up to Spokane in early 1917. But I didn't stay. I just visited a friend of mine. I was living here for two or three days. And I didn't come to live in San Diego, in San Francisco, until I'd been in Spokane a year in Baltimore.
I see. Now, when you, so in San Diego, your only political involvement was?
It was minimum. I wasn't doing anything. Actually, when it kind of came to active participation in any kind of radical movement, I think it started when I first, well, I started writing for all these magazines. And then when the Federated Press was founded in 1920, I think I was with them before 1921. At first I had a column in their daily releases. I had a weekly column and I can't even know what it was about. But after a few months they made me the, when I came to, I was in San Francisco of course then, and they made me the Bay Area South correspondent, and I was with them for 35 years until they expired in 1956. I became probably one of their best known and most regular. Carl Hessler was the head of it, and he just died about a month ago. Of course, so, I got to know any number of people.
Now, you left San Diego after
Judy
about
Stone,
a year.
For instance, who's on the Chronicle now, is the sister of Mark Stone, who was once the Washington correspondent. And every little while I meet people. Well, my friend Carl Brannan in Dallas was the correspondent there. He and his wife were the first people to make, the first civilians to visit Russia after the revolution and things like that. I know, I still know at least a dozen people who had some connection with Federated Press. Linda Coe, for instance. And
I know, I've talked to you in Los Angeles.
Well, he was up here few months ago, and Lee Coe had a party for him over in Berkeley. I saw him at that. So
you left San Diego after about a year then?
Well, I left San Diego early in 1916 and went to Los Angeles.
Why did you make that move? Do you recall?
It had no connection with any theory. We had a chance to rent the house, and also had a chance to get in the movies, so we went up to Hollywood in the early days. I was an extra in the movies in both San Diego and Hollywood for a while, but he had bit parts and got more money.
And what did you work at?
These are old silent films, of course.
And then in Los Angeles, what kind of work did you do?
Well, I had various secretarial jobs, and for a while I was secretary to two lawyers, whose names I've forgotten. And then I was, I answered an advertisement from this big oil company, and the man who was going to be my boss came to see me at the lawyer's office at noon, at lunchtime. He looked me over, and naturally we didn't have much money, and I didn't have very much in the way of a wardrobe. And I still remember what I had on. It was most unbecoming. It was a black and white striped blouse and a beige skirt. And he was very much impressed by my qualifications intellectually. But he looked at me and said, our young ladies all wear black satin. I said, sorry, I have no black satin. Well, he said, have you any kind of black dress? Well, I think I had one, so I had to wear that in the office. It was a very funny office. It was a big, great big thing. Doheny was a prospector, a desert rat, who struck it rich and then found oil in quantities and divorced his old Irish wife, who had supported him by taking in washing, married a blonde floozy. And I remember her, I was there at Christmas, and she came through the office stripping mink and dropped a $5 gold piece on each desk saying, Merry Christmas, my good woman. The girl at the desk next to me had been private secretary to Paderewski and Paso Robles, and she and I just looked at each other and we almost died. But all the officers were British, and most of them were like this retired Irish Anglican minister who was a clergyman who was my boss, and they were very arrogant. Especially the Scots, for some reason. And that's why I finally left there, because one day one of them came. See, I was working on the house organ and also doing Mr. Archer's secretarial work, but it was an easy job, and I had plenty of time when I wasn't doing anything else. So he came in one day. They had another office in the lower floor where they did all the accounting and filing and that kind of thing. And he said, he ordered me in a very arbitrary tone to go downstairs and work on one of the big accounting machines, you know, with a great big long. And I knew I was going to do that sort of thing. But it wasn't, I was going politely and meekly and going to make an awful job of it. And he pointed like that and said, go down there at once. And I can't remember the guy's name, but I turned around and I said, you know, you're making an awful mistake. And he said, what is it? I said, I'm a human being, not a dog. And I walked out and I never went back. But that was the funny thing, because it was about that time that my husband's suggestion, really, I decided that the way to express opposition to the war, since I had nothing else that I qualified to belong to, would be to join the IWW. So we went up to the office, and the IWW, if you remember, was divided according to industries. You were always some kind of industrial or agricultural worker. And what'd they do with me? They couldn't make out what they didn't have. Blue-collar people, so they finally put me in the oil division, and I knew absolutely nothing about oil outside of writing about the company.
So you must have been the only woman in that section.
Oh, no, in that section I must have been. Yes, they had other women, but they were factory workers and that kind of thing. I'm sure I was the only one.
Now, was this
well,
was
I just, I never took any active part. When I was in Chicago in 1918, I did go out and see Bill Haywood to get a story out of him. But aside from that, I had absolutely no connection with the IWW. It was really a protest against the war.
I see.
And a year later in Baltimore, when I had no occasion, I just dropped my membership.
But philosophically, did you the beliefs of the Wobblies in anarcho-syndicalism?
Well, it was, of course... A few years later, I was working very hard with them because of the arrests under the criminal syndicalism law. But I never belonged after 1917.
But at the time that you did join, did you philosophically share the IWW beliefs?
Well, I don't know. That's a question I can't answer because it never arose in my mind. You know, these things just happen. You don't plan. You're going to do this and going to do that. One thing leads to another. When I was in Spokane, I went up there primarily to visit some friends who had been head of the Associated Charities in San Diego, or he had been, and then he got the same position in Spokane. And I was out of a job at the time, and they invited me up, so I went up. And I didn't know it then, but my marriage was breaking up, and things were not too bad. I was just as glad to be going away. So I expected to be only about a week. I stayed there for about 3 months. And naturally, I wasn't going to just sponge on my host, so I got a job packing eggs for Armour and Company. And I was very bad at it. There was a little woman much older than I who worked with me, and the idea was that she took all the eggs out of enormous crates and put them in boxes according to the... And the only instructions we got was, if an egg is cracked, put it in these boxes and we sell them to the confectioners. And what they meant by a cracked egg was anything that was still... had enough shell left to put it in a box. Very often they exploded in your face. And I walked home because I smelled so of sulfur, and I was ashamed to get in the streetcar. But I remember this little woman, I found out her husband was a Wobbly, and she was pasting things under the counter. And I don't know how she happened to confide in me. I think I called somebody a Scissor Bill, and she said, that's what my husband calls people. And
well, what is that? What's the expression?
She was the one when I worked next to me at Armour.
Yeah, what was the expression that you used?
Scissor Bill. Don't you know what a Scissor Bill
is? No, I don't.
Well, that's an old Wobbly term. It means probably a member of the SML, what they used to call a Duke of Labor. In other words, a conventional conservative writers union man. And they were known to the Wallies as Scissor Bills. Just as in the Socialist Party, the people who did all the work without any distinction were called Jimmy Higginses.
But do you know what the derivation of the term is, of the Scissor Bill?
Was it?
Do you know where that expression came from?
I can't imagine. It must have been some specific person they'd known. What the connection had to do with scissors, I don't know. But it was a very common term then.
Now, when you were in the Wobblies in Los Angeles, did you go to the Wobblies?
I never
Hall,
went to meetings. I never did anything except pay my dues. Mm-hmm. In other words, I was the same sort of thing I do now with the half a dozen different interests that I simply can't do anything. I pay my dues, and if they want to use my name, they're welcome to it. But I don't go to meetings, and I don't do anything active. Mm-hmm. Well, the same way I was. That, now it's simply because there are too many different things and because I'm too old and too sick. But then it was simply because it was just a sort of symbol.
Mm-hmm. Now, were you involved in any radical or labor activities in Los Angeles then, besides
not,
that membership?
Not, except for personal acquaintance, no. But, no, I think I went to a few meetings and things of that sort. And there used to be a club at the on Bunker Hill Avenue up above that escalator thing, you know, called the Bunker Hill Club. But I don't know if we ever paid dues in it, but we went to, it was a residence club, and they were all radicals of one kind or another. And my very peculiar husband would go off on well, I don't know, trips to various places, and I'd have to stay back because I was working. And I remember I had a room one time for several weeks on Bunker Hill Avenue with a landlady with a spiritualistic medium. At night when I was reading or working in my room, I could hear this going on underneath. But I can't remember exactly when we went. It was very early in 1916. It may even have been the end of 1915. But by the summer, I was up in Spokane.
Oh, I see. Now,
and then,
did you live in any permanent place, or were you just living in various rooms?
Just a room somewhere. Uh-huh. Just a furnished room. I think we lived in five different places in Los Angeles in the 7 or 8 months we were there. I know we at one time we rented a nice little furnished bungalow on Fountain Avenue out in Hollywood. We were surrounded by a lemon and grapefruit grove, Block Square. Years later, I went to look and show men what it was, and it was all built up in tacky houses. But,
and did you have your typewriter with you all the time and you continued to write?
I think, well, I can't remember whether I had my own typewriter then, but there was one we always had. I've forgotten whether it was mine or his. But
what sort of things were you writing during this period? Mainly poetry?
No, well, I began at then to be writing for magazines like The Masses, and mostly stories and poems primarily. Thorpe Randolph had a magazine called The Messenger that I used to write poems for. Later, when I was covering an CIO convention once, I went up and spoke to him, and he remembered me after all these years. We had quite a conversation. It was a race riot in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Then I remember that I had one poem about, and I can't remember the others.
So then when you left Los Angeles to Seattle, was initially it was just a short visit?
Seattle, not Seattle,
Spokane.
Well, I just went there for a visit. What happened was that my father became very much exercised about the general way I was living, and somehow he wrangled this job for me as the house organ for the olive oil people in Baltimore. The head of it was a patient of his. And so he wired me and offered me the job and offered to pay my fare east. In other words, he wanted to get me away from Austin. So things were in an economic state that I couldn't afford not to take it. And I remember I wired back that I would go if he'd let me go by way of Los Angeles so I could say goodbye to Austin, which I did. And then
when,
went to Baltimore.
When you said goodbye,
I went to Baltimore. I didn't know a single person. I just, by mere chance, looking at a paper, I rented a huge room in on Cathedral Street, which is the first time that anybody on that very fancy street had ever rented out rooms. I was right across the street from Archbishop Gidman. You should see him go out every afternoon in his carriage. But and I remember I was so terribly lonely there. I used to spend all my leisure time reading the telephone book in the hope I'd see a name that I recognized. But then what happened was that a man whom I had known in Los Angeles had a friend who lived in Baltimore, was a member of the Socialist Labor Party, and Frank Lang. And it wasn't before I met Frank Lang. It was Ward something. His first name was Ward, which is rather odd. I've forgotten what his last name was. Anyway, he was an SLP too, and it was through him I met Frank and Angel Lang. And he came to see me and invited me to, well, I think he invited me to the Langs, who were great friends of his, so that I did finally have a few acquaintances, but they all happened to be SLP. And
what were your own beliefs at that time? What were your own beliefs at that time?
Well, I should say they were generalized. I mean, I knew that I didn't approve of the political orientation of the Socialist Party. Matter and I had our early disagreements on that subject. And I always considered the SLP too hidebound. At that time, I think I was still formally a member of the IWW. But we were all in the war, and we were all against the war. I remember one time when Frank, who was an SLP, called me up and said that he was a head printer in some municipal department. Anyway, he found out from his position that there was going to be a raid that night on the IWW headquarters. So he called me to ask me to get in touch with them and warn them. And by that time, I was completely out of touch and didn't know any of them. So I called up Maynard, who was Socialist Party, and he called them and warned them so that they were protected by the time the cops came and placed
this
them
in. This was in Baltimore?
I got rid of everything that the cops would have wanted.
This was in Baltimore?
This was what? This was all in Baltimore, yes. See, As I told you, my uncle came down. He was a traveling salesman for a paint company, and Baltimore was in his territory. So he came down one evening on business, and we had dinner together, and we were walking down Howard Street afterwards. And my uncle suddenly said, "Well, those people have got even here." And he looked up, and here was this building, and it was a great big sign, Socialist Party of Maryland. So I didn't say anything to Uncle Clarence for obvious reasons, but I think that was why I think I'd word Mills, I think his name was. I think I'd met him, but I still was spending most of my time alone in my room, not knowing what to do. So the next evening after work, I went up there, and there was only one man in the office, and I've forgotten his name. And he told me that when their meetings were, and I told him that I was a member of the IWW. And I was not a socialist, but I was interested in anything. And he said, "Do you know our editor? He's this was also the headquarters for the changed his name three times, so I forget what it was called, and Progressive World or something like that. Anyway." He said, he's from California. What's had happened at that time, men had never been south of Menlo Park or Palo Alto, but I, except for 3 days in San Francisco, I'd never been north of Los Angeles. but you know how they are in California. When I left finally to come back here, my then landlord asked me when I got to San Francisco, would I call his brother up and give him his greetings, and I said, I'd be glad to. Where is he? And he said, Los Angeles.
But now, at this time, it was clear to you that your marriage was over.
Well, it wasn't over at that time. The idea was that I was to come east.
I see.
And we had every expectation of rejoining, but unfortunately, that was the time when I met Maynard, and that is the end of that. Well, that's a very complicated thing and nothing I'd want to talk about for a tape recorder, I can assure you.
Were you the one that initiated the dissolution of the marriage, or was Collier the one? Or was it mutual?
I can't answer that because it's entirely too complicated a thing. It wasn't like an ordinary marriage in a great many ways. And as a matter of fact, at one time when we lived in Mill Valley, Anza came up and spent 6 weeks with us. Made it very embarrassing by taking walks and telling everybody he met that he was staying with his wife and her lover. We were posing as brother and sister, so it made it a little uncomfortable. I was working there for the Maryland Casualty Company.
So then in Baltimore is when you first met Maynard Shipp.
Oh, yes. He'd gone to Seattle as a boy of 15 and spent most of his youth between Seattle and San Francisco. But this time he still had two brothers left in Baltimore, and he went back on a visit, and while he was there, they asked him to edit he was organizing the Socialist Party, and they asked him if he would edit the paper, so he stayed on to edit and lived with his brother and his brother's wife and child, and I don't know why, I didn't want to seem ignorant when this man asked me if I knew Maynard Shipley, because he was in California. I said I'd heard of him. I'd never heard of his name in my life. But I did go to the meeting the next, I think it was a Friday evening or something like that. And that's when I first met Maynard.
So in Baltimore...
But I never joined the Socialist Party myself until 1919.
So in Baltimore, you became somewhat socially involved with the socialists anyhow?
Well, I was... It's hard to explain because the primary thing was the war, which we were all fighting, and they were having all this Palmer raid, you know, and people were being arrested and headquarters were being broken up, and then that was when they started deporting people and all that. So the consequence was that even all the different kinds of radicals who ordinarily would be at sword's points with each other were all cooperating against the common enemy. So I can't say that there was any doctrinaire atmosphere. The whole thing was we're fighting the capitalists, all of us, so we helped each other out.
Were you soapboxing in Baltimore against the war, or that was much too dangerous to do?
Oh, no, there was no, sir. Nobody was allowed to. Nobody was allowed to speak. People were sent to prison for 20 years for saying less than simply saying that they were against the war.
So it was all really very sub rosa.
The whole thing had to, well, very much so, because people we knew were all, practically all of the people with names were being arrested. Mm-hmm. And some of them got long prison sentences. And that was when they started that big IWW trial in Chicago. Well, I can't remember what I told you and what I told the young man from Hayward who's writing a master's thesis, but as I told one of you, this company that I was working for, that I edited the house organ for, sold olive oil and mayonnaise and things made with olive oil, But all the olive oil came from Spain. Well, with the war, there were no more ships to bring things to Spain, and so the company folded, and I was out of a job in a strange city. So it was Frank Lang who had a friend who was with the Maryland Casualty Company, and Frank told me that they were thinking of, because the men were being drafted, they were thinking of training women as claim adjusters. There never had been any. So I think there were half a dozen of us who applied, and I was the only one who stuck. And they trained me for, I think it was 4 or 5 months in the home office in Baltimore. Then they sent all their adjusters, the new adjusters, out to Chicago, which was their principal training center, and they sent me there for about 2 months. And when I joined them, it was on condition that I'd be transferred to San Francisco.
Oh, I see. And by this time, you and Maynard had developed your relationship?
Yeah, and after, when I left, Maynard gave up his job and started out in a lecturing and organizing tour all the way across the country, which was then a very hazardous, risky thing to do, again, talking against the war and for the party. And it was months and months before I saw him again. I mean, he went all over it. Little towns you never heard of in Montana and Wyoming and places like that. I know.
But your plan when you left Baltimore was that the two of you would join each other in San Francisco?
That was settled. As a matter of fact, by that time we'd lived together for several months. Mm-hmm.
At that point you still hadn't been divorced, though?
Oh, no. We couldn't be married for 3.5 years because he was married too.
I see.
We both had to wait till we got our divorces. I got my final one. His was not due for several months, but his ex-wife died suddenly. So the day I got my final degree, we were married in Santa Rosa.
Now, when you came out to San Francisco then, it was to work for this insurance company still.
Well, I was with them from 1918 to 1923.
Oh, you worked for them even while you
this
started
This was their
department,
their office out here, yes. They still have a great big office here. They're one of the largest old-line insurance companies. And I was, at that time, the only woman claim adjuster, as far as I know, in the world.
And what kind of situation did this put you in, being the only woman claim adjuster?
Well, I don't know. That's obvious. What do you mean? What do I mean by that?
They were all men
except me.
How
every
did
company
the men,
has,
for instance, react towards a woman holding?
Well,
the
only difficulty I had was with the manager, who was a Marylander from the Eastern Shore, very conservative, and not at all pleased that they sent him a woman. So I know that he tried at first to do everything he could to discourage me and get me out. First time he sent me out, at first I did mostly workers' compensation cases. He sent me up to Fort Bragg to see a man who'd been cut in pieces by a circular saw. I took that without me. By that time I was writing detective stories for the Pulp. It didn't bother me a bit. And then he sent me down to Lindsay to see farmhand who'd had his fortune tractor rear back on him and crush him. And then when he found out I wasn't going to be put off by any of those nice little gruesome things, he took another tack. And this was before Prohibition, of course. And so I was handed most of the personal accident and health claims, which meant men suffering from prostatitis and things like that. And then one of our policyholders was a saloon keeper named Cassidy down Lower Market Street. And Mr. Morris sent me to interview Cassidy, who had a claim to see whether he was back at work. And in those days, women didn't go in saloons. And there might be a back entrance where you went to the ladies' room, but you didn't walk in the saloon. But I had to. I still remember how I had to brace myself and open the door, and all these male heads turned around and glared at me. And I said very quickly, "Mr. Cassidy here." And he was. And he was working. So that it is play.
Now, you say you're writing at this time, you were beginning to write for the Pulp magazine.
Oh, yes, but I was doing every kind of writing. People ask me what I do in the way of writing. I do hash. I've written everything except westerns and love pulps. I even wrote confessions for a while. But then, actually, as I say, I went to the Federated Press in 1921.
Now, but that wasn't a full-time position?
That was...
Was that a full-time
well,
job?
Well, it was, let's say, when you're doing work like being a claim adjuster, you're out on the street all the time, and nobody knows how much of your time you're sending to people you have to see and how much you're calling for news. Well, I made my regular rounds, and one of the places that I had to visit was the IWA headquarters, which was right around the corner from our office, the financial district. It was the old Russ building, but before the present building was put up, one of those old-fashioned office buildings they used to have where you'd have big open place and galleries. Manager's office in Oakland was the same kind. And so this was 1923, just before I went on vacation that summer, and I walked into a raid. And as soon as I realized what was happening, I just made some noncommittal remark and got out. The secretary, the man in charge of the office, I think his name was Frank Connors afterwards. He was one of the people in San Quentin for criminal syndicalism. In fact, that may have been the day he was arrested. I don't know, but he tipped me off right away, and I got out as fast as I could, but not fast enough, because the... what they then called the Red Squad, Mulberg and O'Brien. And much to my pleasure, Mulberg later shot himself to death, committed suicide. But anyway, they immediately followed me and went around to the office and informed Mr. Morris that I had been at the IWA headquarters. So then, he didn't say anything then. I had my... I guess it was, he did. It was probably the next day he called me in, and he said... this report had been made. And then he told me what he hadn't told me for 5 years, that when I first came there in 1918, Mulberg and O'Brien had called on him and told him that I was out here organizing for the IWW and that I had been Bill Haywood's secretary. Well, Bill Haywood I met just once, and we didn't... I made an unfortunate remark, and he didn't like me at all. He had a very unhappy visit. But anyway... And he said he told him then that he would keep an eye on me, and if I didn't try to convert any of the staff, and the idea of converting those dumb little Irish Catholic stenographers and file clerks and all was funny. He wouldn't do anything, but now he told me. And so he said, well, your vacation's due, and then you come back, you take 2 weeks to clean up, and then we'd better be separated. So I was out of the job in 1923, and I had a pretty strenuous time for a while.
Now, during this time, what sorts of work were you doing for the Federated Press?
Well, all I got from Federated Press, they were always hard up, of course. I got $20 a month, so I could hardly live on that.
Now, what sort of stories were you doing for them? You would visit the IWW?
I was just like any reporter. I not only covered all labor conventions and meetings of every kind, including the Labor Council. There was no CIO then. It was all AFL. And I also covered all the various Mooney hearings and trials and retrials, the whole business of Mooney and Billings hearings.
Now,
all those years, I covered all the Bridges hearings when they tried deporting. And in other words, every kind of labor news was in my province and for the whole Bay Area.
Now, how did you happen to start with them?
The
Federated Press?
Well, by that time, in those circles, I had a reputation. And when I first heard of the formation of this news service, I wrote and asked if they could use me, and they told me to send them some stuff, and I sent them the headquarters in Chicago. And I wrote a column for him for a while. I can't even remember what it was about now. And then they asked me at the end of a few months if I would